You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Hi, this is Meg Riley with The View. Today we're going to open with a moment of silence to honor those who were killed in the shooting in Oregon last week. So we're just going to be quiet for a minute, sit with their memories and our grief. Thank you for doing that with us. I'm Meg Riley here in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where it is legal to carry concealed weapons in public places unless they're posted otherwise, and I wish that were not so. I invite other people to introduce themselves, and then we'll introduce our special guest and get going. Patrice, you want to start? You were saying something interesting about Florida.
Sure. Hi, this is Reverend Patrice Curtis in Clearwater, Florida, which is on the Gulf of Mexico. And the weather is beautiful. Sadly, Florida is considering going from a concealed carry state, which is what we are, to open carry. So we'll see how that unfolds.
I'm Aisha Hauser, and I'm in Seattle, Washington.
And I'm Tom Shade in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
And I'm Bob LaValle in Buffalo, New York.
And our special guest today is Linda Susan Ulrich, also in Ann Arbor, Michigan right now. And Linda Susan was at the White House recently for the briefing and policy discussion around bisexuality, so we're really interested to talk to her. But first, we have people who have been traveling. Aisha, why don't you tell us about your trip to Chicago and what happened there?
Okay, so last week I was at a convent that actually is located right in the middle of Chicago, so that was cool, the Cenacle. And I met with a group of folks actually from all from the UUMA. I was the only non-UUMA person, non-minister. It is a committee of the UUMA called CARM, the Committee on Anti-Racism and Multiculturalism, and they're working on a book. And the book, I don't know that I can give out a working title yet, but what it's about is being a religious leader being a religious leader of color in a mostly white denomination. So I'm co-writing a chapter with Reverend Natalie Fenimore of Shelter Rock on religious education, and other folks wrote from different aspects of their experiences and their ministries. And so I've never been part of anything like this before. So all the authors were convened, and with us were folks invited to write responses. So we presented our chapter, another person gave a response, and then the discussion was recorded. So the discussion is also going to be in the book. So it was really, really interesting. It was one of the most compelling, engaging. You know, usually it was really an intense 2.5 days, and usually, you know, there's shiny object for me and I tone out, but there was no zoning out. I mean, it was, everything was, every conversation was a shiny object, and it was amazing. I was really, really blessed to be there and really honored. It was great.
That's really cool. Now, were you representing Laredo? Were you there?
No, so Mark Morrison Reed at the Selma has always said, you know, who are you in relationship with, right, and how you make connections. So because I have been part of, that's how I know Patrice and Linda Susan, the religious professionals of color, we meet in a retreat I've been going for on and off for 8 years. And it's there that I became friendly with, close with many ministers of color who I otherwise wouldn't have any other opportunity to meet. So it was one of those ministers who I am super grateful for, Mitra Ranama, who is now in Long Beach, who invited me to a CARM breakfast at GA two two GAs ago, and I was sitting next to Natalie Fenimore, and they were talking about proposals for the book, and she turned to me and she said, we need to write a proposal. I said, okay. So we did. And it is the only chapter on religious education, so I'm really glad because our denominations, while they're mostly white, our religious education programs are where most of our diversity is right now. I mean, we know that because of multicultural families, because of ethnic and multicultural adoptions. So it is, I think, an important piece that I'm glad will be in the book.
Absolutely. That's great.
Yeah.
Very cool. Any sense of when that book's going to be out?
So if all the stars align and God turns out to be a Unitarian, it'll be out by GA, but more, you know, and we want it, you know, as Mary Bernard says, she wants it, this is Skinner House at the UUA, wants it to be a really quality book. So it may not make it out till then, but we're hoping. So we'll see.
Well, that's cool. I have to have a show about that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's very cool. That's kind of the way Soul Work was done, with all the authors
right.
coming together and
that's responding. What somebody said.
And then we did a People So Bold that way as well, though actually people's chapters and presentations did not match up particularly well with that project, but we tried. So anyway, fabulous. Patrice, what have you been up to?
Well, let's see. Last week I had the just the incredible good fortune and so grateful to spend time with program leaders for the College of Social Justice. And that's College of Social Justice has been going on for about 3 years, and so I was able to learn sort of, a lot about how that happened and where it sits between the UUA and UUSC. But what was so wonderful for me was to be in a room with about 19 other folks who are really equally as passionate as I am about the transformative nature of travel, about its ability to stretch us, to lead us to learn how to cross boundaries and to bring back that that experience of crossing boundaries. For example, down in the Southwest, where folks go on the Borderlinks trip and go actually out into the desert to see how immigration is playing out in the lives of folks, to Haiti, to New Orleans, to there's a wonderful new trip where in the Pacific Northwest with the Lemmi tribe, which for those of us who are at GA will remember. There was quite a lot of talk about First Nations and the impact of environmental justice on the lands of First Nations people. And now there's a trip there. So I was in the room and I was able to spend this amazing 2.5 days with people who, you know, really just kind of get it and are really so excited to be able to do this work for themselves and to kind of shepherd and minister to other folks who want to do this. So that's what I've been doing, and I hope in a month or so we'll be able to have, someone from College of Social Justice come on and tell us even more. But for me, it was an intense, but it was also it felt like self-care in this way, in the midst of right starting up a church, in the midst of the new church here. I'm like, no, I just can't do this. I can't squeeze it in. And then I just made myself, and I'm so
that
glad.
That is kind of your home base.
Groomed for a specific trip, Patrice? Will you be doing like Borderlinks, or is it you're just sort of being set up to do any of them?
The way it is, yeah. I think that they have a twinkle in their eye about what trip it's gonna work. But really, all of the program leaders can, you know, nobody sort of put into a silo and said this is the only trip that you do.
You're only Borderlinks or something like that.
Right. Exactly.
You went on Borderlinks. How is that playing out as the time goes on after you did that trip? How's that stuck with you?
It's still really. Oh, you mean Bob's doing?
Well, Borderlinks. Did you do Borderlinks too, Patrice?
I did. I did. UU Justice Ministry of California, not Borderlinks, but it was to Tijuana to see the deportees and to talk to deportees who come over, and we had a service at the wall, which was, you know, you had families on the other side coming, families in Tijuana coming. It was just, it's really heartbreaking. But tell us about your trip.
Well, I could go on. I mean. there's nothing like the way it's made real to go and, for example, there's a place that the Jesuits operate just on the inside of the Mexican border where when people get pushed out, when migrants are, you know, spit out of the U.S. system and pushed out the gate into Mexico, and they're given a check to compensate them, which is just worthless to them, and they could be hundreds of miles from where their actual home is. So sitting there in the heat with these folks, there's just no substituting that. You know, and another interesting thing too was a big part of the trip was the very intentional self-care that the folks leading the trip, and I was there with a bunch of UU ministers, do to help people stay in the moment without being too, you know, I'm talking about the people who are on the trip, the BorderLinks attendees, how to help people stay in the moment without being too traumatized. So we had morning and evening services and this extra time for processing to help people just wrap their heads around the awfulness, I mean, the cruelty, the immorality that they see. So it's like a secondary layer to it. It's really rich. It's really...
Yeah, College of Social Justice believes they like to, you know, bookmark every day with a reflection in the morning and then having some kind of short worship in the evening, because it is really hard to just sit in that, feeling that pain. And a lot of times what we want to do is jump up and say, oh, I can help. I can help serve, or I can, you know, collect something and bring it down or something like that. But just to sit there is really, that's where the internal change starts to happen. So
it's hard. It's really hard.
Really hard. Dick Gilbert used to say, probably still does, that when Jesus was on the cross, the people who would later be Catholics sat at his feet and wept, and the UUs went out and started organizing against the death penalty. You know, and nothing wrong with organizing against the death penalty, but there is something to witnessing too. So, yeah, interesting. Well, Tom, what have you been doing? Anything interesting?
Well, I went away for a while there in September, and so I've been back and kind of sticking close to home. But I did run down to the UUMA retreat, the chapter retreat, and took and learned how to be a better mentor. As all the seminarians and candidates know, the RSCC is going away, and we're in the process of trying to put together in-care systems, and one of those is going to have to involve mentoring, and moving mentoring from just the preliminary fellowship, which is roughly the first few years of someone's ministry, into actually having mentors for candidates, which is the last few years before you are fellowshipped. And so everybody who's a minister now is going to end up a mentor later, sooner or later, because we're going to need everybody mentoring. So we all need to learn how to do it.
Did anything surprise you that you learned? Is there anything?
Oh, you know, it's always the same. I have to, you know, I mean, my constant life lesson is like, shut up, Tom. Listen better. Try to live in other people's space. Quit trying to analyze their life for them. So, you know, the same thing I learned when I was in CPE, the same thing I should have learned when I was in college or elementary school. You know, it's over and over again, I come up against the same. There's always this person in the way of me doing great ministry. That person turns out to be me. So, you know.
Yeah. I was saying to a friend the other day that so many stories, the moral of the story is hug your kids and love your each day, you know?
Yeah, right.
You know. No matter what the story is, that's kind of where it ends. Love the people who are around you and appreciate the day. Like,
yeah, and it's, I think all theological education comes down to, it's not about you. I mean, the number of times you've heard some people go, it's not about you, you know? That's why I look forward to hospice, because then I'm going to look at everybody and go, this is about me now. This is about me.
Fascinating. Well, I'm excited today to be joined by Linda Susan Ulrich, who is Linda Simpson, what is your role there in Ann Arbor? Actually, I don't know your title. I should have asked you that.
I am the consulting minister here in Ann Arbor.
The consulting minister. Who are you consulting?
Well, I am consulting most directly to Gail Geisenhainer, who's the senior minister. But also, it's kind of an assistant minister position in some ways, but there's been just a lot of different kinds of transition. And so coming in with fresh eyes and saying, what do I see? What structures can I help with is a big part of why I'm here.
Very interesting. Well, yeah. That would be a whole show in and of itself. But we actually invited you here because you were at the White House, what was that, 10 days ago or so, was it?
It was the 21st, so
like a couple about weeks.
2 weeks, yeah.
And so can you tell us how you happened to go and describe the event? And
sure. I have done by organizing for a very long time, been an activist. I was in lived in San Francisco for a very long time, and there's a strong bi community there. Towards the end of the time that I was living in the Bay Area, I was part of the LGBT advisory committee for the San Francisco Human Rights Commission. And a major project that I did there was over the years, the LGBTAC, as it's called, had been on the cutting edge of putting out a lot of different reports about different communities. There was a groundbreaking report on the transgender community, which led to a lot of legislation that started in San Francisco and then moved cross country. There's one of the people who was on the LGBTAC and later on staff actually coined the phrase domestic partner. Just a lot of, there was reports about intersex. I mean, just a lot of really groundbreaking work that came out of that committee. And out of all the letters, there was one that was noticeably missing in all of that work. Not that there hadn't been bi folks on the committee level of work making recommendations. And so I was the principal author on a bisexual invisibility report that, as far as we know, is the first of its kind by a governmental body anywhere in the world, certainly in the US. It really drew from a lot of different areas about health disparities, economic disparities, data collection disparities, just a lot of different realms. A lot kind of took off. We could never have predicted how it went gangbusters. That in part led to the first White House briefing, roundtable briefing that happened in 2013. Oh, so I'm sorry. You're not inside my brain and know these all things. What? So the report came out in 2011.
Okay. And was that when the first briefing?
So no. The first briefing was 2013.
Okay.
Which a lot of bi folks were really pushing for a while, and helped organize that. And so this one, in some ways, was a follow-up, but one thing that I think is important to note is that it was organized by the White House when the 2013 one was organized by activists. And so I think that's really key, because that locus of who's taking ownership of really naming and addressing the needs of bisexuals and other people on that part of the spectrum.
You know, it's so interesting. I mean, I was in D.C. for early. Am I echoing?
Yes.
Not to me.
Yes.
Linda Susan, can you hit me? And I'll I'll mute when I'm done. I think when two of us are unmuted. Is that better? Oh, okay. I was going to say, I was in D.C., you know, in the olden days, and it was a huge deal when Bill Clinton said the words lesbian, gay, bisexual. I don't even know if he said bisexual, actually. He may have just said lesbian, gay. And that was when it was the Lesbian Gay Task Force. And he wrote a letter from him and Hillary. And I remember we were all sobbing because we had lived through AIDS with Reagan and the first Bush, never, ever addressing the community at all. And when he just sent a letter, which is a very standard thing to do to people who are meeting, saying, Hillary and I wish you well in your meeting. I mean, people were bawling. It was like a huge deal. And then I was in D.C. through his term and invited to the White House a lot. And then when George W. Bush came in, all of that programming stopped, which is to say that it could stop again if Obama – I mean, that the president has discretion about which communities are invited and reached out to. And so it is a big deal, and it's really exciting to hear about them taking ownership and planning and inviting in the bisexual community themselves. And while I have my mic, I'll just also say that I've heard from the people here who are there that of 90 people who were there, 11 were from the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. So I just want to highlight my areas also, along with San Francisco, really important in this movement. Yay!
Yeah, regional pride, regional pride. What actually happens at these briefings? To just, you know, walk through the thing. Who were you meeting with, and who was there, and what did you do, you know?
So I will preface all of this by saying that it was an off-the-record meeting, so there are certain specifics I have that covenant of not getting into, but there's plenty I can still say. The format in 2013 and the format in 2015 were a little different. This year, there were about 80 activists and researchers and, every corner, service providers from all over the country who were there. And we presented, there were two panels, and we kind of covered 8 issues. The first panel, which I was on, was housing, employment, health, and education. And then the second panel was data collection, violence, immigration, and HIV/AIDS. And so the format was that each of the speakers would present for a few minutes. There'd be some time for questions. And then we were gathered at tables. There were 8 tables. Each one would then discuss what the panelists had talked about through the lens of the issue that they were focusing on. So I spoke about employment issues and was at the employment table as we discussed things afterwards.
Can you pause a minute and say, what are the employment issues for the bisexual community? In a word.
Well,
that's right. No, I'm just curious.
Obviously there's a lot of overlap in the ways different communities are discriminated against. But for example, bisexuals are more frequently sexually harassed. If they're not as likely to be out at work, which given the harassment is not surprising. They're often viewed as unreliable or wishy-washy or can't make a decision, which means that they won't be as frequently promoted. Poverty is a huge issue for the bi community. Where there is data, bisexuals are, you know, that's the sexual orientation with the highest poverty rates.
Gay and lesbian.
I'm sorry?
Out bisexuals have more poverty than out gay and lesbian people? Is that what you're saying?
Or more than lesbians? Because they have...
Definitely more than lesbians.
Interesting. And that's across... That's with all genders of bisexual people?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, and There are income disparities. Bisexuals tend to have lower incomes. So there's a lot that there are a lot of different things that play into that. There was one other thing that I know that I'd mentioned during my presentation that I'm not pulling up, but
I have a question, Susan. I have to plead ignorance. This is not an area that I know a ton about, and it would be is it possible to offer like sort of a really high level view of the kind of dynamics that are driving these policy needs? Like what if you had to like describe the issues facing the bisexual community in 25 words or less? Like the Meg's laughing, but you know,
I 50. Come on.
All right, yeah, 50. But you know, for the beginner, you know, sort of the 101 version.
The 101 version is that there are, on top of the discrimination based on sort of the general queerness, there's a lot of isolation because frequently bisexuals are viewed as other by both the straight community and gay and lesbian community. Obviously not across the board, but looking at broad patterns, there's a kind of isolation and a kind of constantly having to prove our existence is incredibly draining, demoralizing, becomes PTSD. I mean, there are, you know, the kinds of microaggressions that come up constantly, and that minority stress comes out in very particular ways for bi community. And at the same time, being viewed as having privilege. So not actually having privilege, but being assumed that, oh, well, you're just, you know, you're fine. Like, actually, no, we're really, really, really not fine. Because when there's information disaggregating data about bisexuals from data about gays and lesbians, almost every single time the data about bisexuals shows worse outcomes. But when they get all lumped together, a lot of the picture gets worse. But most of the interventions are geared, whether consciously or unconsciously, towards just gays and lesbians and bisexuals.
I see. So it's like an overlooked community. It's an overlooked community within the larger struggle.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's really helpful. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks for the question. It's one of those things where I've lived with this for so long that sometimes it's a good reminder to frame it in that 30,000-foot level.
Are the people reporting out as bi? Because I think what is tricky about bisexuality is really the majority of the population, however life is being lived. If you look at the complexity of desire and dream and, you know, everything, most of us are bisexual, but most of us don't publicly identify that way. And so for people for whom it's central, I loved the Robin Oakes quote that actually you gave to Hannah. I don't know if you remember that at all, but I thought that was a really helpful frame of bisexuality, because it said, you know, it doesn't mean that you have equal desire or equal relationships, but it's just it's kind of off the binary sexuality, the way that off the binary gender lives, mm-hmm. but less of a I would say that I've been out for 36
Maybe
years
you and froze to me. I don't know if that's just me.
Sorry.
I heard the last thing
You're
I heard was...
You're freezing a bit. You're just freezing a bit, Meg.
It's cold up there in Minneapolis.
No, it's beautiful.
I was going to say, is it already cold?
Well, that doesn't make any sense at all.
I think what will be interesting and can see if this rings like possibly true, Linda Susan, is during the time when researchers started looking at gays and lesbians, in that time, in that window when it wasn't sort of okay to be out and then it became more, right, okay, what happened is they discovered that they actually learned more about sort of the life, the economics, the way people were living as more people were willing to come out as lesbian or gay. So I think that that'll be really interesting when we get beyond, when we get to that point where bisexuals can come out too, and then you have a greater number, because in the beginning they used to say that lesbians and gays, you know, were really quite much more poor than once everybody started coming out, discovered that it was a tiny bit better, right? I'm not saying, you know, like, but just more, there was more information. And so it also made it a richer world for more lesbians and gays to come out also, because there were more folks that were coming out and people could say, oh, look, you know, it's not just like this caricature of what it means to be this in this category. So I'm hopeful that the same thing will happen as more bisexuals feel comfortable coming out, that the richness of what it means, right, of who is bisexual. And even as Meg was saying, you know, maybe most of us will go, oh, okay, well, okay, if you're going to describe it that way or define it that way. You know.
Well, what's interesting is that bisexuals actually, like self-identified bisexuals, are actually the largest population within the queer community already. But you wouldn't know that from moving about in the world. But yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I want to make sure that I try and make sure to talk about is that, you know, these health disparities and economic disparities and all of these things are not because bisexuals are inherently crazy. It's, you know, when you, I mean, present company perhaps accepted, I don't know. but when you, you know, when your very existence gets questioned over and over and over and over, it's a little crazy making.
It is. It's invisibilizing. And I mean, Linda Susan, you were here for a year. We never really knew each other, but I knew you were in a relationship with a woman, and in my mind, I went lesbian. And I see that for a year, I invisibilized you without even knowing it. And I'm sure that that happens often, where people just, if you don't come out, people make assumptions based on what they see. I mean, I know somebody I won't name who was applying to be on a UUA committee, and they asked her sexual orientation, and she called me and said, what should I say? I'm bisexual, but I've been
Rose
in a bisexual marriage for years. You know, and I said, well, they're asking if you're connected to that community, and if you're not, I'd say you're heterosexual. But she's not. She's bisexual. So, you know, I think that kind of invisibilizing happens all from no matter how you're living. And so I can see that that would really exhausts people.
And I wonder if some of it is, I think, just our society's almost, I don't know if it's unwillingness or inability to think in a nuanced way. And I think that's why there's so much like Fox News and the right wing have almost an easier argument about everything. It's right or wrong, black or right, yes or no. And so I think the idea of bisexuality is simply so nuanced that I think it's almost part of how we're wired, and it's non-binary thinking is not easy for most people, because most of us are still four, you know, on some level. It's like right or wrong, you know, yes or no, black or white. So I wonder if that's also a part of it.
I absolutely think it is. That, you know, I talk about the shutting down of the imagination, where you know, the phrase two sides to every argument to me leaves out at least a dozen more. And I think bisexuality gets caught in that too. Like, well, what do you mean? You're married to a woman, so now you're a lesbian. Like, no, actually, neither of us has ever identified as lesbian. So there is actually nothing about our relationship that is lesbian, because there are no lesbians in it. And Meg, your point about people, you know, coming out, like, both Emily and I are very out. We are out on a national level as bi. And yet, we've been in newspapers. And yet, you know, we're still misidentified because, you know, you see two men, brain goes to gay. See two women, brain goes to lesbian. You see a man and a woman, brain goes to straight. And any of those people could be bi.
Is that changing with the younger generation? I remember sitting in a car with my genderqueer 19-year-old a couple years ago, and what looked like a lesbian couple walked by to me, and I said, oh, lesbians, thinking we'd have a little bonding. And Gia said to me, you have no idea if those are lesbians.
And that makes me very happy.
Right, now that you say it. And I thought, and certainly with gender, younger people are in a different world altogether. Is that also true around off-the-binary thinking?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is more openness to not assuming, like asking the questions of how do you identify, what pronouns do you want, you know, all of that. And I think actually, you know, the bi and trans communities have been allies, at least in my experience, have been working together really closely and really well for a very long time. And so there's been that solidarity of come in, just. You identify as bi today? Awesome, come in. Oh, you decide fluid works better? Great. Oh, you're coming out as, now you've actually decided that you're lesbian? Okay, well, still come hang out and have brunch with us. We're very friendly people. Like that, you know, and I just want to connect that back too, that I've realized over the years that my theology around radical welcome is deeply rooted in my experience of bi community. That sense of opening the door widely for people is something that I've felt and seen and practiced in my bi community. And I think,
yeah,
I don't know, it's important. Yeah. That's important to me to tie those two.
30 years ago, I heard this feminist theologian talk. I won't name her, but we all respect her. And I went and talked to her afterwards and said, you know who could really help us to envision what you're talking about is bisexuals. And she looked at me, I was young, and she said, honey, be really careful about diseases. And I just wanted to cry. And that's the kind of violence you're up against every day. I can see why there would be PTSD, because I felt like she had punched me. Here she was, this eminent feminist theologian, and I really felt assaulted by that remark. I still, when you just said that about theology, I just, oh God, I hadn't thought of that in years. But it was the presumption, and I remember, because I was in the office when we added bisexual to lesbian gay. I was the director of that office then. And the people who didn't like it was all about promiscuity. It was this unable to conceptualize. And I remember at GA, people getting up to the mic and talking about promiscuity and just unable to conceptualize sexuality without, like, trying to strangle it.
Isn't it amazing how promiscuity gets thrown around in so many situations as the default derogatory framing?
Well, you know, it's just being able to separate, you know, relationship status with sexuality, as you know, because of the anxiety about relationship status, especially for a lot of people in various stages of their life, there's a lot of anxiety about relationship status. So as soon as you separate those two things, or as soon as you bring in something other than kind of heteronormativity or pseudo-heteronormativity into it, they go, talking about different kinds of sexuality immediately threatens relationship statuses. And that, you know, blows people up, you know, if they're anxious about that. But the idea, you know, I mean, I think, you know, heterosexual people are, monogamous heterosexual people are aware to some extent of the fact that their relationship is not the sum total of their sexuality, right? I mean, people have all kinds of you know, really, right? You know, there wouldn't be a huge internet porn industry if people didn't, you know, have desires, dreams, fantasies that are way beyond what their current relationship status, you know, embodies. But, you know, somehow that's even considered to be a threat to the relationship status. And that's where a lot of anxiety comes from, the anxiety about promiscuity. Why, if we all admit our sexual desires, we're going to be, you know, sleeping with lots of other people. Well, no. First off, lots of other people don't want to sleep with us. And then secondly...
Well, I think...
Speak for yourself, Tom.
The bigger framing here is that not only are... bisexuality as a concept is running into not only this shutting down of imagination, either or thinking, but also the society's sex negativity, because it is the orientation that has the word sexual not whitewashed out of it. And so people like just can't. You said the S word along with the bi part in front of it and so kind of running. It's harder to avoid when the words gay and lesbian have skirt around that in a different way than the word bisexual does.
I've heard people use a word dually attracted. Is that have you heard that as a euphemism?
Sure,
that gets away from the sexual word.
You know, there's a whole range of ways that people identify under this umbrella of bisexuality. We're seeing a lot of people now in the community talk about bi plus, which is like bisexual, pansexual. Fluid, omnisexual. I mean, choose not to identify. That's actually one of the challenges we have is how do you organize people who may or may not identify with a particular label, but we're all kind of in it together. There's non-monosexual, which is, you know, it's a useful term, but it's not my identity because it's about what I'm not. That one I use more as a descriptor than an identity for myself. It's a challenge. I mean, there are people who are, there's a wide range, and that's.
Are younger people using new language here the way they are around gender? I mean, I know from having a kid that when I say lesbian, it's sort of like I'm in 1950 from Gia's point of view. This is not a hip word. Can I just say it's not? So I wonder about, is that true with bi or bisexual too, or are people, younger people, okay with that one still?
I think there are actually a lot, the most, from the stats that I remember seeing, the majority of queer youth actually do identify as bi. I think a lot of queer youth use queer. I think there are a lot of people who identify as pansexual, that works for them better. There's some tension because there are a lot of people who identify as pansexual who think that bi is only binary. You only mean cis women and cis men, when actually a lot of people whose lived experience as bisexual is like, actually, no, just means same sex and different sex. It's fine. Do you know that we like organized together before you were born, really? So I think there's, you know, the language hasn't caught up to the nuance. You know, like Aisha was saying, that there's so much richness in, I mean, it's human sexuality. It's, you know, it doesn't fit in a box unless that's what you want and have a consenting partner.
The White House span generations, the meeting there?
It did. There were people who, there was a woman who has recently won asylum. She's in her early 20s. There were people who'd been who were in their 70s and 80s, who'd been, you know, working on this for decades, and everyone in between. It was an incredibly diverse group of people. It was really beautiful to be in that room and to have the diversity of experiences and, I mean, just every way you can think of for a group of 80 people to be diverse, it was there.
Did the president come through, or was it AIDS?
I'm sorry?
Did the president?
The president was not. Yeah. No, the president was not there. We were all, I should also mention that we were there 2 days before the Pope arrived, so there was a lot of the apocalypse was coming, you know. and so a lot of the administration was highly, highly focused on on getting ready for Pope Francis to arrive.
I have a question from a viewer.
Yay.
There's a viewer who just wrote in, interested to know if there are resources available that you might recommend, Linda Susan, maybe organizations on the national level, and also
sure.
Also any resources that helped you raise your awareness or made you feel less alone.
Those are great questions. Binet USA is a national organization that's been doing a lot of great work. There's also the Bisexual Resource Center, which is based in Boston, but also has a lot of great resources available. And just recently, the 25th anniversary edition of an anthology called By Any Other Name just came out, and that has been a great resource for people just hearing other stories and feeling less alone. There's some great books that have come out, anthologies like Recognize, which is specifically about the stories of bisexual men who often are not seen in a lot of these conversations. Binet USA and the Bisexual Resource Center would be a great place to start to also maybe find local groups and other books that would help.
What about UU-specific sources or resources? Whether it's something written or whether it's, you know, a person or whether it's a group or...
I'm not sure offhand, actually. Me. which is unfortunate. Because our movement has been really great on gay and lesbian, increasingly great on trans,
yeah.
And just mostly silent about bisexual, which is very telling to me. I went to preach a sermon about when the bee is silent. And it was interesting. There was someone who talked to me afterwards about saying how I came across as really angry in that sermon. And I'm thinking, why aren't you angry about these disparities of, you know, the highest suicidality is among bisexuals, you know, all these health disparities, all of these different ways of domestic violence, like intimate partner violence, is just through the roof for bisexuals. Just to give you a taste of it, there was a CDC report that came out a couple years ago where the rates of domestic violence for bisexual men was higher than even the rates for straight women. And we know how messed up it is for straight women. But no one's talking about it. So sadly, I don't know about UU-specific groups, and I would think I would.
Yeah, I remember when we added the name, back, this is 1993 we're talking about, there were Bobby Keppel and Alan Hamilton and some people with theory and resources that came in and did training, but that was 22 years ago. And now that you say it, I'm like, have been, because the trans stuff has been painfully bad and it's changing. And I think it's time. I think it's really, this is a movement whose time has come. And I'm grateful to the White House because I'm chagrined here. I've been part of the problem. I mean, I think, it's time. Certainly there are a lot of CLF members who identify as bi all the time, and, you know, but we haven't really done anything. And I think the marriage equality, how did the marriage equality work settle for bisexual people? Because it's kind of a two-edged sword, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, so much of the language is around gay marriage, or, oh, look how now gay and lesbian couples can get married and have rights. It's like, oh, wow. You know, that's very hard. And yet, at the same time, I feel like there's such a strong legal case to be made of, if I want to marry a man, I was fine. Still same person, if I want to marry a woman, suddenly I don't have civil rights. How is that okay? So anyway,
So I'm a little ignorant here. Can you tease out for me a little bit more exactly what you're talking about as far as marriage goes, and how, if you are bisexual, how that's different if you're same sex and wanting to get married? Or,
I mean, in some ways it's not. And especially, you know, now I could marry whoever would be willing to do that, except I'm already married. So I like the person that said yes. So, but I just mean, if you think in terms of a legal argument before the SCOTUS decision in June, the same person's civil rights, my civil rights, depend on the happenstance of who I fell in love with. In terms of the same person's civil rights could flip. Where that possibility is indeed open, I guess. Where my willingness to marry a man, marry a woman, marry someone who's genderqueer, those would be equally open to me as someone who identifies as bi. And yet, legally, they're not equally open. I guess that's what I was getting at, if that makes sense. It's one of those.
You find that the bi community worked with lesbian and gays before SCOTUS? Did you feel like they were, united communities working?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, my partner Emily and I were very, very involved with marriage equality stuff. Other bi activists that we know in California were also very much on the forefront of this work. So it's not like we were absent from the fight by any means.
I think the other piece that's really hard about this, and I keep seeing Anthony Scalia. I went to one of the Supreme.
I'm sorry.
three in 1992, which specifically denied civil rights to gay, lesbian, bisexual people, and got overthrown by the Supreme Court. But I remember his face as he asked this question: what exactly would bisexual identity mean? And because so much of the arguments that I've heard that I've never gone with for a minute are this: why would anyone choose to be gay? You know, they're born that way. And because they're born that way, it's discrimination not to let them have rights. To which I've always said, first of all, that's not the case for many people I know who identify, especially as lesbian. And second of all, what does that do to bisexual people if you say that? You know, it just like, boom, you have no, just, you're fine, just choose that way, you know? And that whole thing of it's not a choice, I think isn't that one of the stranglers of bisexual people?
Yes. Yeah, it's a tough argument to hang hat on, because it says, well, you know, where does that leave me? And to me, the choice is whether or not to be out and genuine in my life. I can be authentic or not. And for me, that means being out and visible as bisexual or not. The born that way argument is a very, very tender place to hang your hat at all. So yeah, thank you for mentioning that.
Well, we're way beyond the White House, and I see we're coming up on time. Was there more about the White House that you wanted to mention? I can see that really there's just some really basic conversation that's so important to have here. But Bob,
I ask a question about the White House? I'm so intrigued about this off-the-record element of it. And
you froze for a second.
I'm sorry?
Oh, you froze. I just...
Okay. I'm really wondering how, when it's a public venue sponsored by a government organization, you can have off-the-record conversations. And I don't mean to distract from the larger issue, but I'm curious about that.
Well, the idea is that by having these conversations not be on the record, there can be an openness in the room. And a candor in the room that there, people are going to be following up with policy. There were these 8 fantastic policy papers that were part of that discussion that people are going to be following up with the agencies that are relevant to those areas. So it's not like this is the end of the conversation. It's not like it's the only conversation, because there was a lot of groundwork to create those policy papers too. There are upsides and there are downsides. It's early in the process still.
My other question is, did you steal a spoon?
I did not. No spoons. No.
Did you get M&Ms? Did you get presidential M&Ms? When I was in Colombia and they...
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Did you get presidential M&Ms?
We did not. Technically, we were in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, but
it sounds so much better to say.
Well, we were invited by the administration, and it's a beautiful building. So, I'm not complaining at all.
Although it was always hard to be in meetings in the Indian Treaty Room and think that they were going to mean anything. That was one of the most beautiful rooms there. It was called the Indian Treaty Room, and I'd just be like, why should we believe a word that the government is saying right now?
Totally fair.
Yeah. Great thought.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Linda Susan.
My pleasure.
Here's my prayer. National Coming Out Day is coming. I think people who identify as bisexual in the UUA, come out. I mean, I think it would be really interesting. And I think... I thank you for carrying on. It does sound like you've really been out in the eye of the hurricane. And so thanks to all of you bisexual activists who have been who you are authentically and openly these many years. Any parting words from anyone? And we'll end with you, Linda Susan.
Okay.
Well, thanks. I've learned a lot and, very good. Very interesting. Great show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Especially the high-level stuff was really helpful for me as a relative novice with the issue. So thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for your work.
Yeah, thank you. And I would just, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the questions and the attentiveness. And I would just add, I put out an ask to everyone listening to this, is that when you hear those little microaggressions around bisexuals don't exist or whatever it might be, to counter what I'm starting to call them micrograces, of just challenging, like, well, actually, bisexuals do exist. Or, that thing that you just, that is joke you just made was not actually funny. It hurts people and it has consequences. And so micrograces.
That's beautiful. I like that, micrograces. Let us.
So thank you all very much.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. So let's have a week of micrograces. That's a nice aspiration. Hold on to that one. Okay, see everybody. See you next time.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.